Chapter 50. A week after Ringer arrived, Squad 53 moved up from 10th to 7th place. By week 3, we'd edged past Squad 19 to take 5th. Then, with only 2 weeks to go, we hit a wall, falling 16 points back from 4th place, a nearly insurmountable deficit. Poundcake, who isn't much for words but is a boss with numbers, breaks down the spread. In every category except one, there's very little room for improvement. We're second in obstacle course, third in air raid and the run, and first in other duties as assigned. A catch-all that includes points for morning inspection and conduct befitting a unit of the armed forces. Our downfall is marksmanship, where we rank 16th, despite kick-ass shooters like Ringer and Poundcake. Unless we can pull up that score in the next 2 weeks, we're doomed. Of course, you don't have to be a boss with numbers to know why our score is so low. The squad leader sucks at shooting. So the sucky shooting squad leader goes to the senior drill instructor and requests extra practice time, but his scores don't budge. My technique isn't bad. I do all the right things in the right order. Still, if I score one headshot out of a 30-round clip, I'm lucky. Ringer agrees it's just dumb luck. She says even Nugget could score 1 out of 30. She tries hard not to show it, but my ineptitude with a gun pisses her off. Her former squad ranks 2nd. If she hadn't been reassigned, she'd be guaranteed to graduate with the first class and be first in line for a pair of sergeant stripes. I've got a proposition for you, she says one morning as we hit the yard for the morning run. She's wearing a headband to hold back her silky bangs. Not that I notice their silkiness. I'll help you on one condition. Does it have anything to do with chess? Resign as squad leader. I glance at her. The cold has painted her ivory cheeks a bright red. Ringer is a quiet person. Not Poundcake quiet, but quiet in an intense, unnerving way, with eyes that seem to dissect you with the sharpness of one of Dumbo's surgical knives. You didn't ask for it. You don't care about it. Why not let me have it? She asks, keeping her eyes on the path. Why do you want it so bad? Giving the orders is my best chance to stay alive. I laugh. I want to tell her what I've learned. Vosh said it. I knew it to the bottom of my soul. You're going to die. This wasn't about survival, it was about payback. Following the path that snakes out of the yard and across the hospital parking lot to the airfield access road. In front of us now, the power plant barfing its black and gray smoke. How about this, I suggest. You help me. We win. I step down. It's a meaningless offer. We're recruits. It isn't our call who's squad leader, it's Resnick's. And I know this really isn't about who's squad leader anyway. It's about who makes sergeant when we're activated for field duty. Being squad leader doesn't guarantee a promotion, but it can't hurt. A Black Hawk thunders overhead, returning from night patrol. Ever wonder how they did it? She asks, watching the chopper swing off to our right toward the landing zone. Got everything running again after the EMP strike? No, I answer honestly. What do you think? Her breath's tiny white explosions in the frigid air. Underground bunkers. It has to be. That or... Or what? She shakes her head, puffing out her cold, pinched cheeks, and her black hair swings back and forth as she runs, kissed by the bright morning sun. Too crazy, zombie, she finally says. Come on. Let's see what you got, football star. I'm 4 inches taller than she is. For every one stride I take, she has to take 2. So I beat her. Barely. That afternoon, we hit the range, bringing Oompa along to operate the targets. Ringer watches me fire off a few rounds, then offers her expert opinion. You're horrible. That's the problem. My horribleness. I give her my best smile. Before the alien Armageddon happened, I was known for my smile. Not bragging too much, but I had to be careful never to smile while I drove. It had the capacity to blind oncoming traffic. But it has absolutely no effect on Ringer. She doesn't squint in its overwhelming luminescence. She doesn't even blink. Technique is good. What's going on when you shoot?
Generally speaking, I miss.
She shakes her head. Speaking of smiles, I've yet to see so much as a thin-lipped grin from her. I decide to make it my mission to coax one out of her. More a Ben thought than a zombie one, but old habits die hard.
I mean, between you and the target?
She says.
Huh?
Well, when it pops up, no. I'm talking about what happens between here. Fingertips on my right hand. And there. Pointing at the target 20 yards away.
You've lost me, Ringer.
You have to think of your weapon as part of you. Not the M16 firing. You firing. It's like blowing on a dandelion. You breathe the bullet out.
She swings her rifle off her shoulder and nods to Oompa.
She doesn't know where it'll pop up, but the head of the target explodes in a shower of splinters before it even gets upright.
It's like there's no space. Nothing that isn't you. The rifle is you. The bullet is you. The target is you. There's nothing that's not you.
So basically what you're saying is I'm blowing my own head off. I almost got a smile with that one. The left corner of her mouth twitches.
That's very zen-like. I try again.
Her eyebrows come together.
Strike three.
It's more like quantum mechanics.
I nod seriously.
Oh, sure. That's what I meant to say. Quantum mechanics.
She turns her head away.
To hide a smile? So I don't see an exasperated eye roll? When she turns back, all I get is that intense, stomach-tightening stare.
Do you want to graduate?
I want to get the hell away from Resnick.
That isn't enough.
She points across the field at one of the cutouts. The wind plays with her bangs.
What do you see when you sight a target?
I see a plywood cutout of a person.
Okay. But who do you see?
I know what you meant. Sometimes I picture Resnick's face.
Does it help?
You tell me.
It's about connection, she says.
She motions for me to sit down. She sits in front of me, takes my hands.
Hers are freezing, cold as the bodies in P&D. Close your eyes. Oh, come on, zombie. How's your way been working for you?
Good. Okay. Remember, it's not you and the target. It's not what's between you, but what connects you.
Think about the lion and the gazelle. What connects them?
Hunger?
That's the lion. I'm asking what they share.
This is heavy stuff. Maybe it was a bad idea accepting her offer. Not only do I have her thoroughly convinced I'm a lousy soldier, now there's a real possibility that I'm also a moron.
Fear, she whispers in my ear, as if she's sharing a secret. For the gazelle, fear of being eaten. For the lion, fear of starvation. Fear is the chain that binds them together.
The chain. I carry one in my pocket attached to a silver locket. The night my sister died was 1,000 years ago. That night was last night. It's over. It's never over. It isn't a line from that night to this day. It's a circle. My fingers tighten around hers.
I don't know what your chain is, she goes on, warm breath in my ear. It's different for everyone. They know. Wonderland tells them. It's the thing that made them put a gun in your hand. And it's the same thing that chained you to the target.
Then, as if she's read my mind.
It isn't a line, zombie. It's a circle.
I open my eyes. The setting sun creates a halo of golden light around her.
There is no distance.
She nods and urges me to my feet. It's almost dark. I bring up my rifle and tuck the butt against my shoulder. You don't know where the target will rise. You only know that it will. Ringer signals Oompa, and the tall, dead grass rustles to my right a millisecond before the target pops. But that's more than enough time. It's an eternity. There is no distance. Nothing between me and the not me. The target's head disintegrates with a satisfying crack. Oompa gives a shout and pumps his fist in the air. I forget myself and grab Ringer around the waist.
swinging her off the ground and twirling her around. I'm one very dangerous second away from kissing her. When I set her down, she takes a couple of steps back and tucks her hair carefully behind her ears. "That was out of line," I say. I don't know who's more embarrassed. We're both trying to catch our breaths, maybe for different reasons.
"Do it again," she says.
"Shoot or twirl? Which one?" Her mouth twitches. Oh, I'm so close. The one that means something. Chapter 51. Graduation Day. Our new uniforms were waiting for us when we returned from morning chow, pressed and starched and neatly folded on our bunks. And an extra special bonus surprise. Headbands equipped with the latest in alien detection technology. A clear, quarter-sized disc that slips over your left eye. Infested humans will light up through the lens. Or so we're told. Later that day, when I asked the tech exactly how it worked, his answer was simple. Unclean glows green. When I politely asked for a brief demo, he laughed. "You'll get your demo in the field, soldier." For the first time since coming to Camp Haven, and probably for the last time in our lives, we are kids again. Whooping it up and jumping from bunk to bunk, throwing high fives. Ringer is the only one who ducks into the latrine to change. The rest of us strip where we stand, throwing the hated blue jumpsuits into a pile in the middle of the floor. Teacup has this bright idea to set them on fire and would have if Dumbo didn't snatch the lit match from her hand at the last second. The only one without a uniform is sitting on his bunk in his white jumpsuit, legs swinging back and forth, arms folded over his chest, bottom lip stuck out a mile. I'm not oblivious. I get it. After I'm dressed, I sit beside him and slap him on the leg. "You'll get your turn, Private. Hang in there."
"2 years, zombie."
"So? Think what a hard ass you'll be in 2 years. Put all of us to shame." Nugget's being assigned to another training squad after we deploy. I promised him he could bunk with me whenever I'm on base, though I have no idea when, or if, I'm ever coming back. Our mission is still top secret, known only to Central Command. I'm not sure even Resnick knows where we're going. I don't really care, as long as Resnick stays here. "Come on, soldier, you're supposed to be happy for me," I tease him. "You're not coming back." He says it with so much angry conviction that I don't know what to say. "I'll never see you again."
"Of course you're going to see me again, Nugget. I promise."
He hits me as hard as he can. Again and again, right over my heart. I grab his wrist, and he lays into me with his other hand. I grab that one and order him to stand down.
"Don't promise, don't promise, don't promise! Don't promise anything ever, ever, ever!"
His little face screwed up with rage. "Hey, Nugget! Hey!" I fold his arms over his chest and bend down to look him in the eye. "Some things you don't have to promise. You just do." I reach into my pocket and pull out Sissy's locket. Undo the clasp. I haven't done that since I fixed it at Tent City. Circle broken. I draw it around his neck and hook the ends together. Circle complete. "No matter what happens out there, I'll come back for you," I promise him. Over his shoulder, I see Ringer come out of the bathroom, tucking her hair beneath her new cap. I stand at attention and snap off a salute. "Private Zombie reporting for duty, squad leader!"
"My one day of glory," she says,
returning the salute.
"Everybody knows who's making sergeant."
I shrug modestly. I don't listen to rumors.
"You made a promise you knew you couldn't keep,"
she says matter-of-factly, which is pretty much the way she says everything. The unfortunate thing is she says it right in front of Nugget.
"Sure you don't want to take up chess, Zombie? You'd be very good at it."
Since laughing seems like the least dangerous thing to do at that moment, I laugh. The door flies open, and Dumbo shouts,
"Sir, good morning, sir!"
We rush to the ends of our bunks and stand at attention as Resnick moves down the line for what will be our final inspection. He's subdued, for Resnick. He doesn't call us maggots or scumbags. He's nitpicky as ever, though. Flintstone's shirt is untucked on one side. Oompa's hat is crooked. He brushes off a speck of lint that only he can see from Teacup's collar. He lingers over Teacup for a long moment, staring down into her face, almost comical in its seriousness.
Well, Private, are you ready to die?
Sir, yes, sir!
Teacup shouts in her loudest warrior voice. Resnick turns to the rest of us.
How about you? Are you ready?
Our voices thunder as one.
Sir, yes, sir!
Before he leaves, Resnick orders me front and center.
Come with me, Private.
Final salute to the troops, then. See you at the party, children. On my way out, Ringer gives me a knowing look, as if to say, told you so. I follow two paces behind the drill sergeant as he marches across the yard. Blue-suited recruits are putting the finishing touches on the speaker's platform, hanging bunting, setting up chairs for the high brass, unrolling a red carpet. A huge banner has been hung across the barracks on the far side. We are humanity. And on the opposite side, we are one. Into a nondescript one-story building on the western side of the compound, passing through a security door marked Authorized Personnel Only. Through a metal detector manned by heavily armed, stone-faced soldiers. Into an elevator that carries us four stories beneath the earth. Resnick doesn't talk. He doesn't even look at me. I have a pretty good idea where we're going, but no idea why. I nervously pick at the front of my new uniform. Down a long corridor awash in fluorescent lighting. Passing through another security checkpoint. More stone-faced, heavily armed soldiers. Resnick stops at an unmarked door and swipes his keycard through the lock. We step inside a small room. A man in a lieutenant's uniform greets us at the door, and we follow him down another hallway and into a large private office. A man sits behind the desk, leafing through a stack of computer printouts. Vosh. He dismisses Resnick and the lieutenant, and we're alone.
At ease, Private.
Spread my feet. Put my hands behind my back, right hand loosely gripping my left wrist. Standing in front of the big desk, eyes forward, chest out. He is the supreme commander. I'm a private, a lowly recruit, not even a real soldier yet. My heart is threatening to pop the buttons on my brand new shirt.
So, Ben, how are you?
He's smiling warmly at me. I don't even know how to begin to answer his question. Plus, I'm thrown by his calling me Ben. It sounds strange to my own ears after being zombie for so many months. He's expecting an answer, and for some stupid reason I blurt out the first thing that pops into my head.
Sir, the private is ready to die, sir!
He nods, still smiling, and then he gets up, comes around the desk, and says,
Let's speak freely, soldier to soldier. After all, that's what you are now, Sergeant Parrish.
I see them then. The sergeant's stripes in his hand. So Ringer was right. I snap back to attention while he pins them on my collar. He claps me on the shoulder, his blue eyes boring into mine. Hard to look him in the eye. The way he looks at you makes you feel naked, totally exposed.
You lost a man, he says.
Yes, sir.
Terrible thing.
Yes, sir. He leans back against the desk. Crosses his arms.
His profile was excellent. Not as good as yours, but the lesson here, Ben, is that we all have a breaking point. We're all human, yes?
Yes, sir. He's smiling. Why is he smiling? It's cool in the underground bunker, but I'm beginning to sweat.
You may ask, he says with an inviting wave of his hand.
Sir?
The question you must be thinking. The one you've had since Tank showed up in processing and disposal.
How did he die?
Overdose. As you no doubt suspected. One day after being taken off suicide watch.
He motions to the chair beside me.
Have a seat, Ben. There's something I want to discuss with you.
I sink into the chair, sitting on its edge, back straight, chin up. If it's possible to be at attention while seated, I'm doing it.
We all have our breaking points.
He says. blue eyes bearing down on me.
I'll tell you about mine. 2 weeks after the fourth wave, gathering survivors at a refugee camp about 6 kilometers from here. Well, not every survivor, just the children. Although we hadn't detected the infestations yet, we were fairly confident whatever was going on didn't involve children. Since we couldn't know who was the enemy and who wasn't, it was command's decision to terminate any and all personnel over the age of 15.
His face goes dark. His eyes cut away. Leaning back on the desk, gripping its edge so hard, his knuckles turn white.
I mean, my decision.
Deep breath.
We killed them, Ben. After we loaded up the children, we killed every single one of them. And after we were done, we incinerated their camp. Wiped it off the face of the earth.
He looks back at me. Incredibly, I see tears in his eyes.
That was my breaking point.
Afterward, I realized, to my horror,
that I was falling into their trap. I was an instrument for the enemy. For every infested person I murdered, 3 innocent people died. I will have to live with that. Because I have to live. Do you understand what I mean?
I nod. He smiles sadly.
Of course you do.
We both have the blood of innocence on our hands, don't we? He pushes himself upright. All business now. The tears are gone.
Sergeant Parrish, today we will graduate the top 4 squads of your battalion. As commander of the winning squad, you have first pick of assignments. 2 squads will be deployed as perimeter patrols to protect the base. The other 2 will be deployed into enemy territory.
This takes me a couple minutes to absorb. He lets me have them. He picks up one of the computer printouts and holds it in front of me. There's a lot of numbers and squiggly lines and strange symbols that mean absolutely nothing to me.
I don't expect you to be able to read it, he says. But would you like to guess what this is?
That's all it would be, sir, I answer. I guess.
It's the Wonderland analytics of an infested human being.
I nod. Why the hell am I nodding? It's not like I understand.
Ah, yes, Commander, an analytic. Please, go on. We've been running them through Wonderland, of course, but we haven't been able to untangle the infestation's maps from the victims, or clone, or whatever it is. Until now.
He holds up the readout.
This, Sergeant Parrish, is what an alien consciousness looks like.
Again, I'm nodding. But this time because I'm starting to get it. You know what they're thinking.
Exactly.
Beaming at me. The star pupil.
The key to winning this war isn't tactics or strategy or even imbalances in technology. The real key to winning this war, or any war, is understanding how your enemy thinks. And now we do.
I wait for him to break it to me gently. How does the enemy think?
Much of what we assumed is correct. They have been watching us for some time. Infestations were embedded in key individuals around the world. Sleeper agents, if you will, waiting for the signal to launch a coordinated attack after our population had been whittled down to a manageable number. We know how the attack turned out here at Camp Haven, and we strongly suspect that other military installations were not as fortunate.
He slaps the paper on his thigh.
I must have flinched because he gives me a reassuring smile.
A third of the surviving population, planted here to eradicate those who survived the first 3 waves. You, me, your team members, all of us. If you have any fear, as poor Tank did, that a 5th wave is coming, you can put it aside. There will be no 5th wave. They have no intention of leaving their mothership until the human race is exterminated.
Is that why they haven't
attacked us again? We think so.
It seems their foremost desire is to preserve the planet for colonization. Now we are in a war of attrition. Our resources are limited. They can't last forever. We know it. They know it. Cut off from supplies with no means to marshal any significant fighting force, eventually this camp, and any others out there like it, will wither and die, like a vine cut off from its roots.
Weird. He's still smiling. Like something about this doomsday scenario turns him on. So what do we do, I ask.
The only thing we can do, Sergeant. We take the battle to them.
The way he says it. No doubt, no fear, no hopelessness. We take the battle to them. That's why he's the commander. Standing over me, smiling, confident, his chiseled features reminding me of some ancient statue, noble, wise, strong. He is the rock against which the alien waves crash, and he is unbroken. We are humanity, the banner read. Wrong. We're pale reflections of it, weak shadows, distant echoes. He is humanity, the beating, unbeaten, invincible heart of it. In that moment, if Commander Vosh had told me to put a bullet through my head for the cause, I would have. I would have without a second thought.
Which brings us back to your assignment, he says quietly. Our recon flights have identified significant pockets of infested combatants, clustered in and around Dayton. A squad will be dropped in, and for the next 4 hours, it will be on its own. The odds of making it out alive are roughly 1 in 4. I clear my throat, and 2 squads stay here. He nods, blue eyes boring deep, to the marrow deep. Your call. That same small, secretive smile. He knows what I'm going to say. He knew before I walked through the door. Maybe my Wonderland profile told him, but I don't think so. He knows me. I rise from the chair to full attention and tell him what he already knows. Chapter 52. At 0900, the entire battalion musters in the yard, creating a sea of blue jumpsuits headed by the top 4 squads in their crisp, new fatigues. Over 1,000 recruits standing in perfect formation, facing east, the direction of new beginnings, toward the speaker's platform erected the day before. Flags snap in the icy breeze, but we don't feel the cold. We are lit from within by a fire hotter than the one that turned tank into ash. The brass of Central Command moves down the first line, the winning line, shaking our hands and congratulating us for a job well done. Then, a personal word of gratitude from the drill instructors. I've been dreaming of what to say to Resnick when he shakes my hand. Thanks for making my life a living hell. Oh, die. Just die, you son of a bitch. Or my favorite, short and sweet, and to the point. F you. But when he salutes and offers me his hand, I almost lose it. I want to hit him in the face and hug him at the same time. Congratulations, Ben, he says, which totally throws me off. I had no idea he even knew my name. He gives me a wink and continues down the line. There are a couple of short speeches by officers I've never seen before. Then the Supreme Commander is introduced and the troops go crazy, waving our hats, pumping our fists. Our cheers echo off the buildings encircling the yard, making the roar twice as loud and us seem twice as many. Commander Vosh raises his hand very slowly and deliberately to his forehead, and it's as if he hit a switch. The noise cuts off as we raise our own hands in salute. I can hear quiet snuffling all around me. It's too much. After what brought us here, and what we went through here, after all the blood and death and fire, after being shown the ugly mirror of the past through Wonderland, and facing the uglier truth of the future in the execution room, after months of brutal training that pushed some of us past the point of no return, we have arrived. We have survived the death of our childhood. We are soldiers now. Maybe the last soldiers who will ever fight, the Earth's final and only hope, united as one in the spirit of vengeance. I don't hear a word of Vosh's speech. I watch the sun rising over his shoulder, framed between the twin towers of the power plant, its light glinting off the mothership in orbit, the sole imperfection in the otherwise perfect sky. So small, so insignificant. I feel like I can reach up and pluck it from the sky. Throw it to the ground, grind it to dust beneath my heel. The fire in my chest grows white hot, spreads over every inch of my body. It melts my bones. It incinerates my skin. I am the sun gone supernova. I was wrong about Ben Parrish dying on the day he left the convalescent ward. I've been carrying his stinking corpse inside me all through basic. Now the last of him is burned away as I stare up at the solitary figure who lit that fire. The man who showed me the true battlefield, who emptied me so I might be filled, who killed me so I might live. And I swear I can see him staring back at me with those icy blue eyes that see down to the bottom of my soul, and I know what he's thinking. We are one, you and I, brothers in hate, brothers in cunning,
brothers in the spirit of vengeance.
Part 7. The Heart to Kill. Chapter 53. You saved me. Lying in his arms that night with those words in my ears, and I'm thinking, idiot, idiot, idiot. You can't do this. You can't, you can't, you can't. The first rule, trust no one, which leads to the second rule. The only way to stay alive as long as possible is to stay alone as long as possible. Now I've broken both. Oh, they're so clever. The harder survival becomes, the more you want to pull together. And the more you want to pull together, the harder survival becomes. The point is, I had my chance, and I didn't do so well on my own. In fact, I sucked. I would have died if Evan hadn't found me. His body is pressed against my back. His arm is wrapped protectively around my waist. His breath a delicious tickle against my neck. The room is very cold. It would be nice to climb under the covers, but I don't want to move. I don't want him to move. I run my fingers along his bare forearm, remembering the warmth of his lips, the silkiness of his hair between my fingers. The boy who never sleeps, sleeping, coming to rest upon the Cassiopeian shore, an island in the middle of a sea of blood. You have your promise, and I have you. I can't trust him. I have to trust him. I can't stay with him. I can't leave him behind. You can't trust luck anymore. The others have taught me that. But can you still trust love? Not that I love him. I don't even know what love feels like. I know how Ben Parrish made me feel, which can't be put into words, or at least any words I know. Evan stirs behind me. It's late, he murmurs. You better get some sleep. How did he know I'm awake? What about you? He rolls off the bed and pads toward the door. I sit up, my heart racing, not sure exactly why. Where are you going?
Going to look around a little? I won't be long.
After he leaves, I strip off my clothes and slip on one of his plaid lumberjack shirts. Val had been into the frilly sleepwear, not my style. I climb back into bed and pull the covers up to my chin. Dang, it's cold. I listen to the quiet of the Evanless house, that is. Outside are the sounds of nature unleashed, the distant barking of wild dogs, the howl of a wolf, the screech of owls. It's winter, the time of year when nature whispers. I expect a symphony of wild things once spring arrives. I wait for him to come back. An hour goes by, then two. I hear the telltale creak again and hold my breath. I usually hear him come in at night, the kitchen door slamming, the heavy tread of his boots coming up the stairs. Now I hear nothing but the creaking on the other side of the door. I reach over and pick up the Luger from the bedside table. I always keep it near me. He's dead, was my first thought. It isn't Evan outside that door. It's a silencer. I slide out of bed and tiptoe to the door. Press my ear against the wood. Close my eyes to focus. Holding the gun in the proper two-handed grip the way he taught me. Rehearsing every step in my head like he taught me. Left hand on knob. Turn, pull, two steps back, gun up. Turn, pull, two steps back, gun up. Creak. Okay, that's it. I fling open the door, take just one step back, so much for rehearsal, and bring up the gun. Evan jumps back and smacks against the wall, his hands flying up reflexively when he sees the muzzle glinting in front of his face. Hey! He shouts, eyes wide, hands up like he's been jumped by a mugger. What the hell are you doing? I'm shaking with anger. I was coming back to check on you. Can you put the gun down, please? You know I didn't have to open it. I snarl at him, lowering the gun. I could have shot you through the door. Next time I'll definitely knock. He gives me his trademark lopsided smile. Let's establish a code for when you want to go all creeper on me. One knock means you'd like to come in. Two means you're just stopping by to spy on me while I sleep. His eyes travel from my face to my shirt, which happens to be his shirt, to my bare legs, lingering a breath too long before returning to my face. His gaze is warm. My legs are cold. Then he knocks once on the jamb, but it's the smile that gets him in. We sit on the bed. I try to ignore the fact that I'm wearing his shirt, and that shirt smells like him, and he's sitting about a foot away also smelling like him, and also that there's a hard little knot in the pit of my stomach like a smoldering lump of coal. I want him to touch me again. I want to feel his hands, as soft as clouds. But I'm afraid if he touches me, all 7 billion, billion, billion atoms that make up my body will blow apart and scatter across the universe. "Is he alive?" he whispers. That sad, desperate look is back. What happened out there? Why is he thinking about Sam's? I shrug. How can I know the answer to that? I knew when Lauren was. I mean, I knew when she wasn't. Picking at the quilt, running his fingers over the stitching, tracing the borders of the patches like he's tracing the path on a treasure map. I felt it. It was just me and Val then. Val was pretty sick, and I knew she didn't have much time. I knew the timing, almost down to the hour. I'd been through it 6 times. It takes him a minute to go on. Something's really spooked him. His eyes won't stay still. They dart around the room as if trying to find something to distract him. Or maybe the opposite, something to ground him in the moment. This moment with me. Not the moment he can't stop thinking about. One day I was outside, he says, hanging up some sheets to dry on the clothesline, and this weird feeling came over me, like something had popped me in the chest. I mean, it was totally physical, not mental. Not a little voice inside my head telling me that Lauren was gone. It felt like someone had punched me hard, and I knew. So I dropped the sheet and hauled ass to her house. He shakes his head. I touch his knee, then pull my hand back quickly. After the first touch, touching becomes too easy. How'd she do it? I ask. I don't want to make him go someplace he's not ready to go. So far he's been an emotional iceberg, 2/3 hidden beneath the surface, listening more than he talks, asking more than he answers. Hung herself, he says. I took her down. He looks away. Here with me, there with her. Then I buried her. I don't know what to say. So I don't say anything. Too many people say something when they really have nothing to say. I think that's the way it is, he says after a minute. When you love someone, something happens to them, and it's a punch in the heart. Not like a punch in the heart, a real punch in the heart. He shrugs and laughs softly to himself. Anyway, that's what I felt. And you think since I haven't felt it, Sammy must be alive? I know. He shrugs and gives an embarrassed laugh. It's stupid. I'm sorry I brought it up. You really loved her, didn't you? We grew up together. His eyes glow at the memory. She was over here, or I was over at her house. Then we got older and she was always over here, or I was always over there, when I could sneak away. I was supposed to be helping my dad on the farm.
That's where you went tonight, isn't it? Lauren's house.
A tear falls onto his cheek. I wipe it away with my thumb, the way he wiped my tears away on the night I asked him if he believed in God. He leans forward suddenly and kisses me. Just like that.
Why did you kiss me, Evan?
Talking about Lauren, then kissing me. It feels weird.
I don't know.
He ducks his head. There's enigmatic Evan, taciturn Evan, passionate Evan, and now shy little boy Evan. The next time you better have a good reason, I tease him.
Okay.
He kisses me again. Reason? I ask softly.
You're really pretty.
That's a good one. I don't know if it's true, but it's good. He cups my face in his soft hands, and then leans in for a third kiss that lingers, igniting the simmering lump in my belly, making the hairs on the back of my neck stand up and do a little happy dance.
It is true, he whispers, our lips brushing.
We fall asleep in the same spooning position we were in a few hours before, the palm of his hand pressing just below my neck. I wake in the dead hours of the night, and for a second I'm back in the woods inside my sleeping bag, just me, my teddy bear and my M16, and some stranger pressing his body into mine. No, it's okay, Cassie, it's Evan, the one who saved you, the one who nursed you back to health, and the one who's willing to risk his life so you can keep some ridiculous promise. Evan, the noticer who noticed you. Evan, the simple farm boy of the warm, gentle, soft hands. My heart skips a beat. What kind of farm boy has soft hands? I ease his hand away from my chest. He stirs, sighing against my neck. Now the hairs tickled by his lips dance a different kind of jig. I lightly brush my fingertips over his palm. Soft as a baby's bottom. Okay, don't panic. It's been a few months since he did any farm work, and you know how nice his cuticles are. But can years of calluses be wiped away by a few months off hunting in the woods? Hunting in the woods. I dip my head slightly to sniff his fingers. It's probably my overactive imagination. But do I detect the acrid, metallic smell of gunpowder? When did he fire a gun? He hadn't gone hunting tonight just to visit Lauren's grave. Lying wide awake in his arms as dawn breaks, feeling his heart beating against my back while my own heart pushes against his hand. You must be a lousy hunter. You hardly ever come back with anything. I'm actually very good. You just don't have the heart to kill? I have the heart to do what I have to do. What do you have the heart to do, Evan Walker? Chapter 54. The next day is agony. I know I can't confront him, way too risky. What if the worst is true? That there is no Evan Walker farm boy, only Evan Walker human traitor. Or the unthinkable, one word that pretty much sums up this alien invasion. Evan Walker, silencer. I tell myself this last possibility is ridiculous. A silencer wouldn't nurse me back to health, much less give me nicknames and play snuggles in the dark. A silencer would just, well, silence me. Once I take that irreversible step of confronting him, it's pretty much game over. If he isn't who he claims to be, I'd be giving him no choice. Whatever his reason for keeping me alive, I don't think I'd stay alive very long if he thought I knew the truth. Go slow. Work it out. Don't tear through it like you always do, Sullivan. Not your style, but you gotta be methodical for once in your life. So I pretend nothing's wrong. Over breakfast, though, I work the conversation around to his pre-arrival days. What kind of work did he do around the farm? Name it, he says. Drove the tractor, baled hay, fed the animals, repaired equipment, strung barbed wire. My eyes on his hands while my mind makes excuses for him. He always wore gloves as the best one, but I can't think of a natural-sounding way to ask. So, Evan, you have such soft hands to have grown up on a farm. You must have worn gloves all the time and been even more into hand lotion than most guys, huh? He doesn't want to talk about the past. It's the future he's worried about. He wants details about the mission. Like every footstep between the farmhouse and Wright-Patterson has to be mapped out, every contingency considered. What if we don't wait till spring and another blizzard hits? What if we find the base abandoned? How do we pick up Sammy's trail then? When do we say enough is enough and give up? I'll never give up, I tell him. I wait for nightfall. I was never very good at waiting, and he notices my restlessness. You're going to be okay? Standing by the kitchen door, rifle dangling from his shoulder, cupping my face tenderly in those soft hands, and me gazing upward into those puppy dog eyes. Brave Cassie. Trusting Cassie. Mayfly Cassie. Sure, I'll be fine. You go out and bag a few people and I'll pop some corn. Then locking the door behind him, watching him step lightly off the back porch and trot toward the trees, heading west, toward the highway, where, as everyone knows, Fresh game like deer and rabbit and Homo sapiens like to congregate. I tear through every room. 4 weeks locked up inside it like someone under house arrest, you think I would have poked around a little? What do I find? Nothing. And a lot. Family photo albums. There's baby Evan in the hospital wearing the striped newborn hat. Toddler Evan pushing a plastic lawnmower. 5-year-old Evan sitting on a pony. 10-year-old Evan on the tractor. 12-year-old Evan in a baseball uniform. And the rest of his family, including Val. I pick her out right away. And seeing the face of the girl who died in his arms and whose clothes I've taken brings the whole shitty thing back to me. And suddenly I'm like the lowest person left on Earth. Seeing his family in front of the Christmas tree, gathered around birthday cakes, hiking along a mountain trail, forces it down my throat. The end of Christmas trees and birthday cakes and family vacations and the 10,000 other taken-for-granted things. Each photograph the tolling of a bell, a timer clicking down to the end of normal. And she's in some of the pictures, too. Lauren. Tall. Athletic. Oh, and blonde. Of course, she would have to be. They make a very attractive couple. And in more than half the pictures, she isn't looking at the camera. She's looking at him. Not the way I would look at Ben Parrish, all squishy around the eyes. She looks at Evan fiercely like, "This here? It's mine." I put the albums away. My paranoia is fading. So he has soft hands, so what? Soft hands are a nice thing. I build a roaring fire to heat up the room and push back the shadows that crowd in on me. So his fingers smell like gunpowder after visiting her grave, so what? There are wild animals running around everywhere. And it wasn't the kind of moment where you go, "Yeah, I went to her grave, had to shoot a rabid dog coming back, by the way." Ever since he found you, he's taken care of you, kept you safe, been there for you. But no matter how much I lecture myself, I can't calm down. I'm missing something. Something important. I pace back and forth in front of the fireplace, shivering despite the roaring flames. It's like having an itch you can't scratch. But what could it be? I know in my gut I'm not going to find anything incriminating, even if I tear through every inch of the house. But you haven't searched everywhere, Cassie. You haven't looked in the one place he wouldn't expect you to look. I limp into the kitchen. Not much time now. Grab a heavy jacket from the hook by the door and a flashlight from the cupboard, tuck the Luger into my waistband and step outside into the bitter cold. Clear sky, the yard bathed in starlight. I try not to think about the mothership a few hundred miles over my head as I shuffle toward the barn. I don't click on the light until I step inside. The smell of old manure and mildewed hay. The scampering of rats' feet on the rotting boards over my head. I swing the light around, over the empty stalls and across the dirt floor, into the hayloft. I don't know exactly what I'm looking for, but I keep looking. In every creepy movie ever made, the barn is the prime nesting ground for the things you don't know you're looking for and always regret finding. I find what I'm not looking for under a pile of ratty blankets heaped against the back wall. Something long and dark glinting in the circle of light. I don't touch it. I reveal it, tossing aside 3 blankets to reach its resting place. It's my M16. I know it's mine. I can see my initials in the stock. C.S. scratched there one afternoon while I hid in the little tent in the woods. C.S. for completely stupid. I'd lost it on the median when the silencer struck from the woods. Left it there in my panic. Decided I couldn't go back for it. Now here it is in Evan Walker's barn. My bestie had found its way back to me. Do you know how to tell who the enemy is in wartime, Cassie? I back away from it, back away from the message it sends. Back all the way to the door while I keep the light shining on its glossy black barrel. Then I turn and run smack into his rock-hard chest. Chapter 55. "Cassie?" he says, grabbing my arms to keep me from falling straight back onto my butt. "What are you doing out here?" He glances over my shoulder into the barn. I thought I heard a noise. Dumb? Now he might decide to investigate. But it's the first thing that pops into my head. Blurting out first thoughts is something I really should work on if I live past the next 5 minutes. My heart is pounding so hard I can feel my ears ringing. "You thought you..." "Cassie, you shouldn't come out here at night." I nod and force myself to look into his eyes. Evan Walker is a noticer. "I know, it was stupid, but you've been gone a long time." "I was stalking some deer." He's a big, Evan-shaped shadow in front of me. A shadow with a high-powered rifle against the backdrop of a million suns. "I bet you were." "Let's go inside, okay? I'm freezing to death." He doesn't move. He's looking into the barn. "I checked it out," I say, trying to keep my voice steady. "Rats." "Rats?" "Yeah, rats."
"You heard rats? In the barn? From inside the house?"
"No, how could I hear rats from there?" An exasperated roll of the eyes would be good right about now, not the nervous laugh that escapes instead. "I came out on the porch for some fresh air."
"And you heard them from the porch?"
"They were very big rats." Flirty smile. I whip out what I hope passes for one of those, then I hook my arm through his and pull him toward the house. It's like trying to move a concrete pole. If he goes inside the barn and sees the exposed rifle, it's over. Why the hell didn't I cover up the rifle? "Evan, it's nothing. I got spooked, that's all."
"Okay."
He shoves the barn door closed and we head back to the farmhouse, his arm draped protectively over my shoulders. He lets the arm fall when we reach the door. "Now, Cassie. Quick sidestep to the right, Luger from your waistband, proper two-handed grip, knees slightly bent, squeeze, don't pull, now." We step inside the warm kitchen. The opportunity passes. "So I take it you didn't bag any deer," I say casually.
"No."
He leans the rifle against the wall, shrugs out of his coat. His cheeks are bright red from the cold. "Maybe you shot at something else," I say. "Maybe that's what I heard." He shakes his head.
"I didn't shoot at anything."
He blows on his hands. I follow him into the great room where he bends in front of the fireplace to warm his hands. I'm standing behind the sofa a few feet away. My second chance to take him down. Hitting him from this close would not be a challenge. Or it wouldn't be if his head resembled an empty can of creamed corn, the only kind of target I was used to. I pull the gun from my waistband. Finding my rifle in his barn didn't leave me with many options. It was like being under that car on the highway, hide or face. Doing nothing about it, pretending everything was fine between us, accomplished nothing. Shooting him in the back of the head would accomplish something. It would kill him. But after the crucifix soldier, it had become one of my priorities never to kill another innocent person. Better to show my hand now while that hand holds a gun. "There's something I should tell you," I say. My voice is shaking. "I lied about the rats."
"You found the rifle."
"Not a question." He turns. With his back to the fire, his face is in shadow. I can't read his expression, but his tone is casual.
"I found it a couple of days ago off the highway. Remembered you said you dropped one when you ran. Then I saw those initials and I figured it had to be yours."
For a minute, I don't say anything. His explanation makes perfect sense. I just didn't expect him to jump right into it like that. "Why didn't you tell me?" I finally ask. He shrugs.
"I was going to. Guess I forgot." "What are you doing with that gun, Cassie?"
"Oh, I was thinking about blowing your head off, that's all. Thought you might be a silencer or maybe a traitor to your species or something along those lines. Ha ha!" I follow his eyes to the weapon in my hand, and suddenly I feel like bursting into tears. "We have to trust each other," I whisper. "Don't we?"
"Yes,"
he says, moving toward me now.
"We do." But how do you make yourself trust someone? I say. He's beside me now. He doesn't reach for the gun. He's reaching for me with his eyes. And I want him to catch me before I fall too far away from the Evan I thought I knew, who saved me to save himself from falling. He's all I've got now. He's my itty-bitty bush growing out of the cliff that I cling to. Help me, Evan. Don't let me fall. Don't let me lose the part of me that makes me human.
You can't make yourself believe anything, he answers softly. But you can let yourself believe. You can allow yourself to trust.
I nod, looking up into his eyes. So chocolatey warm. So melty and sad. Damn it, why does he have to be so damn beautiful? And why do I have to be so damn aware of it? And how is my trusting him any different from Sammy's taking the soldier's hand before climbing onto that bus? The weird thing is, his eyes remind me of Sammy's, filled with a longing to know if everything will be all right. The others answered that question with an unequivocal no. So what does that make me if I give Evan the same answer? I want to. Really, really bad. I don't know how it happened, but my gun is now in his hand. He takes my hand and leads me around to the sofa, sets the gun on top of Love's desperate desire, sits close to me, but not too close, and rests his elbows on his knees. He rubs his large hands together as if they're still cold. They're not. I had just held one.
I don't want to leave here, he confesses. For a lot of reasons that seemed very good until I found you.
He claps his hands together softly in frustration. It isn't coming out right.
I know you didn't ask to be my reason for going on with everything. But from the moment I found you...
He turns and grabs my hands in his. And suddenly I'm a little scared. His grip is hard. His eyes swim with tears. It's like I'm holding him back from tumbling over the edge of a cliff.
I had it all wrong, he says. Before I found you, I thought the only way to hold on was to find something to live for. It isn't. To hold on, you have to find something you're willing to die for.
Part 8. The Spirit of Vengeance. Chapter 56. The world is screaming. Just the icy wind racing through the open hatch of the Black Hawk. But that's what it sounds like. At the height of the plague, when people were dying by the hundreds every day, the panicky residents of Tent City would sometimes toss an unconscious person into the fire by mistake. And you didn't just hear their screams as they were burned alive. You felt them like a punch to your heart. Some things you can never leave behind. They don't belong to the past, they belong to you. The world is screaming. The world is being burned alive. Through the chopper windows, you can see the fires dotting the dark landscape, amber blotches against the inky backdrop, multiplying as you near the outskirts of the city. These aren't funeral pyres. Lightning from summer storms started them, and the autumn winds carried the smoldering embers to new feeding grounds. Because there was so much to eat, the pantry was stuffed. The world will burn for years. It will burn until I'm my father's age, if I live that long. We're skimming 10 feet above treetop level, the rotors muffled by some kind of stealth technology, approaching downtown Dayton from the north. A light snow is falling. It shimmers around the fires below like golden halos, shedding light, illuminating nothing. I turn from the window and see Ringer across the aisle, staring at me. She holds up 2 fingers. I nod. 2 minutes to the drop. I pull the headband down to position the lens of the eyepiece over my left eye and adjust the strap. Ringer is pointing at Teacup, who's in the chair next to me. Her eyepiece keeps slipping. I tighten the strap. She gives me a thumbs up, and something sour rises in my throat. 7 years old. Dear Jesus. I lean over and shout in her ear. You stay right next to me, understand? Teacup smiles, shakes her head, points at Ringer. I'm staying with her.
I laugh. Teacup's no dummy. Over the river now. The Black Hawks